It's always a pleasure for me to come to Utah. At the Tax Foundation, we have a team of five people that work on state tax policy, and we visit about 35 states a year. That's our triaging, prioritizing. So last year, I flew about 125,000 miles, all domestic, going to different states and counseling them on their tax problems. And I always appreciate being able to come to this conference because, frankly, it's where I get a lot of the ideas that I then take to other states. As Senator mentioned, Utah is number 8 on our state business tax climate index, and that's not easy to get. I don't know about number 1. Wyoming's number 1 because they don't have any taxes. So as long as you have taxes, it's going to be tough to beat them. But certainly higher than 8 is possible. But 8's really good, and there are, hear it from somebody who's not from Utah and who's in for the day from Washington D.C. There are a lot of things, public finance-wise, that you take for granted in how you administer your government, how you frame your budget, how you set your tax policy, that are just light years ahead of where almost every other state is. And I don't think it's a coincidence that out of all of the organizations that we work with, and we work with organizations in every state, the Utah Taxpayers Association is certainly very high on our list of as one of the best. And Senator Stevenson, even though he has my cell phone number and uses it a lot, I appreciate his role in leading that and setting a good example. So thank all of you for all you do for that. So Billy asked me to be concise and focused, so I'm going to do that and start in 1789. So, because you've heard all day about the federal tax law, but I want to put it into some context about why it happened. And I actually don't think that that's been conveyed a lot. I think there's been a lot of discussion about who won and who lost, a lot of discussion of the partisan kind of what does it mean, but not a lot of why it happened and how it probably would have happened eventually. So just a brief history of the United States tax system is the income tax, of course, is relatively new. It only dates back about 100 years ago. Before that, the U.S. government was a lot smaller, of course, and funded primarily from land sales and excise taxes. And state governments, all the way up to the Depression, were almost 100% through property taxes. And then in the lead up to the Great Depression, the U.S. government began adopting its income and business taxes, and then the payroll taxes in the Great Depression to fund Social Security. And then in 1942, that was kind of the big break point when, in the middle of World War II, to help pay for it, the income tax was converted from a tax primarily on very rich people to a tax on everybody, that everybody pays. And that's also when tax withholding came about. Milton Friedman, who was at the time working in the Treasury, helped design that as something he was never quite regretted, but kind of regretted that it continues to last. States began adopting sales taxes. Our tax rate hit 90% for the individual tax rate at that time. It came down in the 64 Kennedy-Johnson tax cut, and then we had the Reagan tax cuts, and then the 1986 reform. And 1986, before this last bill, was the last time there was really any big structural changes. So why tax reform? What was the big deal about why a lot of people were agitating for something to happen? Four big points. One, our corporate income tax rate, having not changed since 1986, had gone from one of the lowest to one of the highest just by virtue of standing still. Many other countries around the world have cut their taxes. This shows the worldwide weighted average as well as the weighted average of the industrialized countries. We just were no longer competitive on that score. This is a very old chart. I think I should have it updated, but it's from 2006, but I think the lesson still lands. Our income tax, we've got a lot of deductions and credits and exemptions and exclusions, and they add up. And when you take them all out, and many of them are in the code for very good reasons. We've got the standard deduction for all people. We've got exclusions for healthcare. We've got the earned income tax credit. All of them have very noble policy rationales behind them. But when you add them all up, it means 60% of all income earned in the United States is exempt from the income tax. So in order to raise a given amount of revenue, you have to make the rate that much higher on the pie that is left to be taxed. Our marginal tax rate, contrary to popular belief, is actually higher than the OECD industrialized world average. So the total taxes paid when you add it up on a given dollar of income is very high. European countries and other countries have much larger governments, but the way they funded it is through consumption taxes, value-added taxes, sales taxes. Our income taxes are actually fairly comparable. And then a change that's fairly unique for the United States is what used to be a C corporation way back in the day and what would be a C corporation in another country is oftentimes in the United States a pass-through business, an LLC, an S corp, and so forth. So we've seen a dramatic rise in those. So you may see charts now and then about the decline of the corporate income tax over time or the inequality from people paying a lot more. And a lot of that's driven by the fact that income that used to be on the corporate side back in the day is now being earned on the pass-through side. So we have all these issues that people have with driven by the tax code. And so a way I would suggest you look at it is that the tax bill that was passed is essentially a corporate tax reform with individual provisions glommed onto it for political reasons. So the big corporate changes, and I have the initialism PERT to help me remind these things, so like the conditioner. So permanence, the corporate provisions are permanent. Expensing, there's now the ability to expense new purchases that didn't exist before. There's the rate reduction, taking that down from 35 to 21. And then territorial, the move from worldwide to territorial, which is, all of these are very big deals. In addition to that, we have the higher standard deduction, the repeal of the personal exemption, the new pass-through deduction, which if any of you are CPA, that's a job for life for you now. Repatriation international income that was mentioned earlier, the NOL changes that Commissioner Valentine mentioned, and then modification of some business tax credits. And right now the big fight going on all over the country is what states are going to do about these. So I'm going to bring my colleague Jared up here to highlight some of these dilemmas that states are facing, and then I'll come back and tell you what you should do.
Well, thank you for having both of us here today. It's always good to come and talk about these issues. I'm cognizant that this is an after-lunch speech, and usually that's when you bring up the energetic speaker with an exciting topic, and I'm here to talk about tax conformity. So I do apologize for that, and plus, conformity doesn't even sound like an interesting topic. Who wants to conform? I just talked about this at greater length in New England about 2 weeks ago, and as I'm walking to the event, every single street is named after a famous nonconformist who founded the town, and you think, this is not going to be a popular topic, but I think it is an important topic because, of course, there are reasons why states conform to significant elements of the federal income tax code, and almost every state does to a substantial degree. They incorporate this in part because it's simpler that way. It's simpler for the state itself because all of the administrative costs are in some ways reduced. It's simpler for the taxpayer who has fewer compliance costs. You can rely on federal guidance, federal case law. You can rely on on private letter rulings. And of course, the audits that the federal government does will in many ways help inform your decisions here in the state as well. All of these are substantial simplifications. And especially for taxpayers who are operating in multiple states, using the same definitions in every state is so much easier. This is why most states do substantially conform to the federal code. But substantially is the key word here. Every state does differ in some important ways. Because, however, most states do start with some sort of federal definition of either adjusted gross income or federal taxable income, and then adopt some other provisions of the federal code, you are seeing changes flow through from the federal bill, the new law, to the states. And this makes sense, right? Because you have you see two different numbers used at the federal level. You might have heard it's a $1.5 trillion net tax cut over 10 years. Somewhere or other, you might have heard $5.5 trillion. And what do you do with those two numbers? And the key is, in fact, there are $5.5 trillion worth of rate reductions and $4 trillion worth of base broadening. Add those together, $1.5 trillion net over 10 years. But the states only get one side of that because, of course, elements of your code use the base definitions that the federal government uses, so you get that base broadening. You don't, of course, have the rate reductions flowing through. So most states, not all, but most states are seeing additional revenue because of federal tax reform. As the taxpayer at the federal level gets a significant tax cut in most cases, a state taxpayer can be seeing an increase at the state level. That's one reason why Utah made some changes this year with some modest reductions to rates to partially offset that change. Now, this creates, I think, an impetus and an opportunity for tax reform, because really there are three things that a state can choose to do in the aftermath of federal tax reform. I've called it the three R's. No one else is buying that, but the idea here is that you can either retain the money, just say this is a windfall for the state. You can return the money by decoupling from select provisions, trying to go back to the status quo ex ante, whatever your code used to look like, it remains that way. Or you can undertake some sort of tax reform, and that can take the form of rate reductions, it can take the form of making more substantive structural changes to your tax code to not only restore that additional revenue to the taxpayer, but to use that buffer to buy down some of the reforms that you've perhaps been looking at for a long time. Joe already previewed these changes, but I've put some pluses and minuses on there. You can see that there are revenue drivers here, and a lot of these, of course, for most states are revenue increases, but not all. You know, the standard deduction, and Utah uses a credit based on 6% of the standard deduction, that is almost doubling, so of course that's a revenue loss. But the personal exemption is larger than the standard deduction by a substantial amount. At the federal level, there are actually three pieces of this. The third is the expanded child tax credit. Only three states include that in any way, so you don't have that element, and if you conform to the standard deduction and the personal exemption or offer a credit commensurate on both of those, that's a combined net tax increase. And revenue increase. Itemized deductions doesn't matter a lot to Utah because Utah doesn't actually conform generally with these, but that's also a revenue increase. States, there are six of them that would incorporate the pass-through deduction, revenue loss, repatriation, international income can be a windfall, changes on the federal code, on the corporate code rather as a whole, interest deduction and the NOL change is also a revenue increase. And you can just go down the line. On the whole, for almost all states, except some of those that bring in the pass-through deduction, that's the main area where this diverges, these are positive revenue drivers. Now, there are two basic ways that states can conform to the federal tax code. One is rolling conformity, where every year you automatically incorporate all of the major changes in the federal law, or at least all those that you have chosen to link to. The other is static, or fixed date conformity, where you only update to the federal code as specified in your law. So a lot of states will say, we adopt the Internal Revenue Code as it existed as of December 31st, 2015. And if they don't update that, some of the definitions do not change. So you can see that Utah, of course, is rolling conformity on both the corporate and the individual income tax. You're adopting this stuff automatically. Other states are not always there. There are at least five broad ways that federal tax reform drives state revenues, and what's interesting is actually only one of them actually is dependent on whether or not you have rolling conformity, because the income tax starting point is important. Here, it's not so much of a big deal, because federal AGI doesn't have a lot of changes. For the handful of states that use federal taxable income, you're bringing in all the standard deduction changes, you're bringing in the personal exemption change, you're bringing in that new pass-through deduction, and other changes as well, including if you link to itemized deductions, those are all also in the definition of federal taxable income. If, like Utah, you use federal AGI, that income tax starting point changes very little. The moving expense, the deduction is above that line, a few minor provisions. Then there's the specific conformity provisions. These are more important here. Wherever you have consciously said, we are going to link to the federal tax code. So for Utah, this would be bonus depreciation, or now full expensing. This would be the Section 179 small business expensing provision. This would also be, to some degree, the standard deduction and personal exemption. Again, not bringing those in fully, but offering a credit worth 6% of what you get at the federal level. So those are specific conformity provisions. There's fouling uniformity provisions. There's international income and dynamic economic effects. So yeah, this is what the form looks like currently. It's going to change, but this is the current 1040, and you can see how those lines differ, and it makes a difference. What's between there? You're on the top one, so you don't see a lot of changes there. you know, some of these specific conformity provisions we discussed, a few of these are significant to Utah. Some of them aren't, because you're not bringing in a few of these. You don't bring in the itemized deductions. You don't bring in the net operating loss provisions because you handle that separately. You will bring in interest deductibility. You do bring in manufacturing expenses. So that's the old Section 199. That is no longer available because of federal tax reform. Filing status linkage. There are a bunch of states, including Utah, that require you to file the same way at both the federal and state level. So if you are married valid jointly at the federal level, you're also married valid jointly at the state level. Some of the changes in federal law will change whether people choose to do that, and therefore you'll see some change in state filing as well. Itemization linkage is more significant, but it is not relevant here. In some states, you have to choose the same one. So if you shifted to the standard deduction at the federal level, you have to do it at the state. Utah will still allow you to choose, to go a different route there. It's not based on the federal choice. International income, again, not a huge issue here. There are some states that will try to bring in both the repatriation income and other federal income. What you are going to see on international in some states is an effort to try to adopt some of the new base erosion rules. Because as has been discussed a couple of times, there's now this new regime for international taxation, this territorial regime. And there are some safeguards and guardrails put around that. There's GILTI, as was discussed earlier. There's FDII. And then there's BEAT, the base erosion anti-abuse tax. States automatically, all of them, conform to part of GILTI. They bring that into their definition of corporate income if they have a corporate income tax. They don't conform always to the deduction that is on the other side of that. In fact, Utah does not. So that is a lack of balance that exists there if the state doesn't conform on that one provision. Then there's things like BEAT, which arguably states can't even do because this is distinguishing between foreign and domestic income. Federal government can do this. States arguably cannot. That arguably violates the U.S. Constitution, but a couple of states are looking to challenge that. So that's going to be something that we see in the coming years. Another source of revenue, of course, for states will be the dynamic effects. We at the Tax Foundation and other organizations, including, of course, the federal government with JCT and CBO, all say that you are going to see increased domestic investment, and you're going to see GDP increases based on this new federal bill. Now, there are differences. There's a spectrum of just what is expected there, but this is a pretty universal expectation that there will be some new revenue and some new investment. And this is why it's important for states to, I think, keep on their guard here, because there is an opportunity, there's revenue, and there's investment that's coming to this country that might not have otherwise. Now the question is, where does it go? And as has been mentioned many times already today, Utah is already a great place for business. There's a great business tax environment here. There's just a great tax environment generally. But you can lose ground by standing still, which is why there have been discussions already, and Joe's going to bring up a few other ideas for how you continue to build upon the successes here, because that investment has to go somewhere, and the question, of course, is where it goes. There are a few provisions of the federal law that we think are particularly important. Full expensing really does drive investment in a similar, significant way. So both on the corporate and larger business side with 168K and also with small businesses on 179, these are important provisions. The lower corporate rate, of course, makes more investments viable than would have been otherwise. And territorial taxation is a little more complex, but it certainly can induce some investment here that might not have happened otherwise. And again, this economic activity, it's a question of where it goes. So state tax codes really matter here. Most states are anticipating revenue gains. Again, only three thus far have said that they aren't, and they have some very unique circumstances that do not apply either to Utah or any of your neighbors. And I think at that point, I'm going to turn it back over to Joe to talk about some of the specific options, but hopefully that helps with laying the groundwork for what conformity is and means for Utah.
Thank you, Jared. There's an organization in Washington, D.C. called the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. We tussle with them on quite a few things. And their advice on conformity is, it's very direct. It's you should conform to everything that increases your revenue, and you should decouple from everything that would decrease your revenue. So we're a little more circumspect on it. And there are some people saying you should couple from everything, and some people saying you should decouple from everything. We're kind of picking and choosing, but the idea is that you should focus on the stuff that's going to grow the economy. Billy, very earlier today, said, you know, the goal isn't necessarily to lower taxes, it's to advance policy that increases growth in Utah, and by that, you're able to lower taxes. And provisions like the expensing rule and using this as an opportunity for comprehensive tax reform, which Utah has already done in part in 293 and can continue to do in future sessions. Just wanted to wax philosophical about the future for a moment. And this is not necessarily Utah specific, and I'll try to be very brief since apparently the computer's about to die too, up there in the upper right. The future of the sales tax, obviously the state, Utah along with most states, nearly all states, is dependent very heavily on the sales tax. Handed out our booklet, apologies we didn't bring enough, but in there includes a lot of important statistics on different taxes, including dependence on the sales tax. Some big macro trends. Services are growing as a share of all sales. So back in the 1960s, when sales taxes were first widely adopted in most states, goods were a primary share of the economy. Today, services are two-thirds of the economy and growing. So your legal services and your accounting services and your real estate services, which are all exempt from sales tax, are a larger share of the economy than they were back then. And so that leads to the, and online services too, and that leads to the perception that the sales tax is eroding over time. It's not because the economy and consumption is eroding over time. That's very strong. It's because the sales tax, the of what it applies to, has not kept up with what people are buying and selling. Taxation of business inputs creates distortions. That's an article of faith here in Utah, so I don't need to drill that point down. And you know, appreciate all your efforts to remove those double taxations on taxation of business inputs. And you will always face pressure to narrow the tax base on consumption. If you left it completely to polls to design a tax system, you'd have a tax you'd have very high taxes on businesses and hotels, and very low taxes on income and on gasoline because people want to tax other people, and so everybody pays sales tax on groceries. Everybody pays sales tax on clothing. And so there's you'll always face pressure to narrow that tax base. And that's why we have the mantra of good tax policy being a broad base and a low rate, because if you carve things out of the base, that just means the rate has to be that much higher on what's left in the base. The future of the corporate income tax, my chart earlier about the rise of pass-through businesses, one explanation for that is that the 1986 reform made it a lot more tax preferable to be a pass-through business rather than a C corporation. But now a C corporation has a 21% tax rate, and a pass-through business pays ordinary income tax rates somewhere in the 30s. So are we going to see that in return? And I'm really curious about that. I know there's a lot of people associated with the business community in the room, and I'd be interested in knowing whether you're already starting to hear murmurs of people maybe thinking about going in the other direction. And what will that mean for the future of the corporate income tax? Will it suddenly, you know, instead of being kind of the ugly stepchild of state finance, not even amounting to a stool of the three-legged stool, will that be different? Future of the property tax. Property tax is stable, very stable, of course, in Utah. It's huge. It raises an enormous amount of revenue, and it's unpopular. Everybody hates it. So, but because it's so stable and so huge, it makes it hard to do much of anything about it. Many states, of course, cap it in different ways, and we'll continue to monitor that. And then the future of the individual income tax, which really comes down to 2025. All of the individual tax provisions, as someone mentioned earlier, in the federal tax bill now expire in 2024. It's really aggravating how in Washington, D.C., we seem to live on a everything expiring every month kind of deal right now. It causes a lot of gray hairs, and what will be the tax code, I think, will be a big issue in the 2024 election. So I really don't know what will happen. You know, I've seen lots of theories of kind of, well, you know, somebody gets elected, and then we elect the opposite of that person, and then they get kicked out, and then the era comes in, and so trying to extrapolate out, well, what will the 2024 election be like? But we'll be hearing a lot about individual income tax in that year, I think. And that matters for a lot of states because, of course, you couple to all of that. Well, I think that's all I've got. I think we're going to be around for a few more minutes. If you want to ask me terrible stories about other states, I'm always happy to share those. You really don't want to be New Jersey. Senator Niederhaus and I were talking a little about New Jersey's situation, which is not very promising. But again, thank all of you for everything you do to help make Utah public finance one of the examples in the nation to the rest of the states. And then thank you to Billy and Senator Stevenson and everybody at the Utah Taxpayer Association for everything you've done and continue to do. Thank you.